Today is Wednesday, April 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a power struggle in the making as U.S. governors push back against President Trump's claims of ultimate power over their state's restrictions.
We don't have a king in this country.
The International Monetary Fund warns the global economy will likely suffer its worst year since the Great Depression. Also ahead, former President Barack Obama endorses Joe Biden.
Choosing Joe to be my vice president was one of the best decisions I ever made, and he became a close friend. I believe Joe has all the qualities we need in a president right now.
It's all on today's International Edition. At the White House Tuesday, President Donald Trump said during a daily briefing that he has instructed his administration to at least temporarily halt funding to the World Health Organization over its handling of the coronavirus pandemic.
Today, I'm instructing my administration to halt funding of the World Health Organization while a review is conducted to assess the World Health Organization's role in severely mismanaging and covering up the spread of the coronavirus. Everybody knows what's going on there. American taxpayers provide between $400 million and $500 million per year to the WHO. In contrast, China contributes roughly $40 million a year and even less. As the organization's leading sponsor, the United States has a duty to insist on full accountability. One of the most dangerous and costly decisions from the WHO was its disastrous decision to oppose travel restrictions from China and other nations. They were very much opposed to what we did. Fortunately, I was not convinced and suspended travel from China, saving untold numbers of lives. Thousands and thousands of people would have died.
Trump said the group had promoted China's, quote, disinformation about the virus that likely led to a wider outbreak of the virus than otherwise would have occurred. The U.S. is the biggest overall donor to the Geneva-based World Health Organization. Trump has been increasingly critical of the organization as the global health crisis has continued. Governors in the United States are starting to map out plans for reopening their economies in a slow and methodical process to prevent a new wave of coronavirus cases and more tragic consequences. President Trump has repeatedly expressed his desire to see the U.S. reopen for business very quickly. And on Monday, he insisted that he has total authority over the loosening of those restrictions, even though the Constitution largely delegates such powers to the states.
The authority of the President of the United States having to do with the subject we're talking about is total.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, whose state has had more than 10,000 coronavirus deaths, on Tuesday ridiculed Trump's assertion.
We also have to be clear on who is responsible for each element of the opening. The president said last night that he has total authority for determining how and when states reopen. That is not an accurate statement.
New York has been America's hardest hit, but Cuomo said it appears to be turning the corner. He reported that there have been 778 deaths over the previous 24 hours, but said fatalities are leveling off and hospitalizations and the number of new patients put on ventilators are continuing to drop.
It's basically flat at a devastating level of pain and grief, but it evidences everything else we're seeing, which is basically a flattening at this level.
There have been close to 25,000 deaths and approximately 600,000 confirmed infections in the United States. As the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said, the U.S. does not have the critical testing and tracing procedures needed to begin reopening the nation's economy. World leaders battling the coronavirus pandemic are hoping tests, technology, and a coordinated approach will help them begin easing tight restrictions on movement. In some European nations like Italy and Spain, the process is already underway. But it is a struggle to balance public health with economic well-being. The International Monetary Fund says The pandemic's impact on the global economy will be historically painful. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Just 3 months ago, the IMF forecast global economic growth of 3.3%. Today, a breathtaking downgrade. The IMF saying the world economy will instead shrink 3%, its worst year since the Great Depression. Among specific nations, the IMF's looking at a 5.9% drop in the U.S. and 7.5% in European countries sharing the euro. It's projecting a big rebound next year with 5.8% growth, but acknowledges the prospects are uncertain. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The International Monetary Fund has approved a $500 million package to give 6 months of debt relief to developing nations struggling with the coronavirus pandemic. While the move is being welcomed, some finance experts say the world's wealthiest nations can do more, especially for the African nations on the list. VOA's Anita Powell files this report from Johannesburg.
The IMF's plan, which affects 19 African countries, will allow vulnerable nations to channel more of their scarce financial resources towards vital emergency medical and other relief efforts, the organization said in a statement. Eric Lecompte, executive director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of religious organizations that works for international finance system reform, says the plan will provide much-needed relief to countries like the Central African Republic, Chad, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Liberia, Malawi, Niger, and Rwanda. He spoke to VOA from Washington via WhatsApp.
When we're dealing with the reality that, on average, countries across sub-Saharan Africa have an average of 50 critical care units, we know that they're not going to be able to deal with minor elements of the crisis, let alone more significant ones. In part, that's why we saw all the finance ministers across Africa almost 3 weeks ago now step up and say we need to be able to stop paying debts for all African countries, making a call to stop and suspend debt payments for $44 billion, because they knew that was money that could be quickly invested, moved very quickly into economies to be able to get the ventilators, to be able to increase health systems so that they might be able to combat the virus.
So is the IMF's relief package enough? South African economist Iraja Bedian, who heads Pan-African Investment and Research Services, said the relief package is more symbolic than substantive. And Abidian said, this plan doesn't improve Africa's ability to help itself. The continent's more developed economies like Kenya, South Africa, and Nigeria are not included in the package. The continent needs its developed economies right now, he said. And recent moves in the financial market, like the recent downgrading of South Africa's credit rating to junk status, don't help.
So to the extent that at this very wrong moment, South Africa has been downgraded, it reduces its access to global capital market, it raises the cost of borrowing, and as such, it makes it so much less able to accelerate its capacity to help its own nation, but also in the neighborhood.
And Lecompte said wealthy nations can also do more. He singled out one in particular.
I think one of the challenges we're dealing right now with the G20 in terms of the initial step, which is suspending debt payments, is in particular China has been resistant in the discussion so far. China in particular, because right now China controls 25% of all lending, 25% of all debt in Africa. It doesn't want to change the price tag of that debt.
The African region still has the world's lowest confirmed coronavirus caseload, according to the World Health Organization. But African experts are quick to note gaps in testing and health infrastructure, meaning that even in developed nations like South Africa, there are likely many, many more cases than doctors know about. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is reporting the first national data on how the coronavirus is hitting doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals in the nation. Officials say between 10 and 20% of coronavirus cases are healthcare workers, but medical professionals on the front lines are getting some help through a telemedicine app previously used to track Ebola patients in Uganda. It's now being used by Johns Hopkins Medicine and other hospitals to monitor the health of first responders, doctors, nurses, and caregivers battling COVID-19. Johns Hopkins Head of Infectious Diseases, Dr. Bob Bollinger, joins us now to talk more about how this works.
We're using a mobile health solution called Emoca. And full disclosure, this is a technology that was developed at Hopkins. And I'm one of the inventors and on the board. But it's a mobile health technology that was originally developed to support public health programs in Uganda many years ago. And then subsequently has been used for supporting lots of health use cases over the years. And about 4 or 5 years ago, during the early Ebola outbreak, we developed a solution with Emoca that would help monitor people returning from Ebola-affected areas in Africa, returning to the United States, so they could self-monitor themselves for symptoms. And that really led to a partnership with the Hopkins Biocontainment Unit, which was set up at that time to prepare for exactly what we're dealing with now. And so a system was developed to help health workers monitor themselves if they were to be exposed to infectious agents like Ebola and certainly like COVID-19. And so that was something that was put into place a couple of years ago. And then, of course, a couple of months ago, when we started to see uptick in cases and we're preparing for this current epidemic, Hopkins asked if Emoca could expand this service to more healthcare workers. And so it's really designed to help health workers very, very efficiently track their symptoms on a daily basis and report those symptoms. And there are really two objectives for this kind of monitoring. One is to make sure that health workers have access to testing if they need it as soon as possible, as well as information about the symptoms they may be having and support for those symptoms if it requires testing or medical care. So by reporting these symptoms, health workers can be linked to services that the hospital systems can offer for them, including testing. That's number one. Number two is it's a way to monitor symptoms very, very efficiently so that it can help make decisions about when health care workers are safe to return to work. And that's also important, obviously. So those are really the two objectives for the program.
Can you explain specifically how it works?
So health systems, including Hopkins, and there are others that are using it, will offer this service to their employees who are at risk for COVID, may have been exposed. They can very efficiently upload the app onto their smartphones, and then the app will walk them through a very efficient method for recording their daily symptoms. It's done very securely through both a checklist as well as a video and a secure chat so that they can actually be able to ask questions. And there's a team of trained people who are on call basically to review the data as it comes in, to answer questions and refer and triage the healthcare workers when necessary to the occupational health departments.
How far into the summer and into the fall do you think that we'll likely still be dealing with this? Or is this something that's just going to be now a way of life for the time being until there is a vaccine?
Well, this virus is not going to go away until we have a vaccine, an effective vaccine. The question is really what types of steps are going to be necessary to deal with it between now and that point in time, which is 12 to 18 months from now when we have a vaccine. And so what we're doing right now is we're trying to mitigate what is sort of the acceleration phase of this big wave that we're facing now. And the idea is to reduce the number of cases as best we can, but it's not going to go away. So after this initial phase, we're going to have to focus a lot on contact tracing and diagnosis. We've got to find ways to expand diagnostics and diagnostic capacity, as well as contact tracing, so we can identify cases similar to what they're doing in places like Korea and Singapore, where they're identifying very, very quickly cases, quarantining those people, doing contact tracing, getting their contacts tested, quarantining them if necessary, so that we can stop the spread. And it's going to take a lot of intensive work. We can certainly leverage mobile health and remote monitoring technology as well to do that, but it's also going to require teams of people to help with that contact tracing. But none of it's really going to be effective if we don't get more testing, because it's all about getting access to testing as quickly as possible. So you can identify cases very, very quickly and do the contact tracing. I think that's the new normal. We're going to get out of this initial phase, and then we're going to have to do a lot of very intensive public health diagnosis and contact tracing until we have a vaccine.
And do you think it's realistic that we can just open everything back up and go back to doing what we do in the beginning of May?
Oh, I don't don't think we're going to be able to just flip a switch. No way. I think we're going to have different strategies, and we can gradually begin to loosen up some of the recommendations, but it's not going to be like a switch goes off. If we get a million people in the country infected, that's still a fraction of 1% of the entire population, right? That means the rest of the population is still at risk. And as long as that virus is circulating in the communities and in the world, the remainder of the population is always going to be at risk for another wave. And so we can't really let our guard down. We can certainly begin to think about strategies to help begin to get the economy back moving again, get people back to work, but it's going to have to be done in a very different way than we did before this epidemic. I think it's going to be necessary to implement some of these strategies until, as you said, we have a vaccine that can protect us.
Johns Hopkins Head of Infectious Diseases, Dr. Bob Bollinger. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Three potential COVID-19 vaccines are making fast progress in early stage testing in volunteers in China and the U.S., but it's still a long road ahead to prove if they will really work. Initial tests focus on safety, and researchers in both countries are trying out different doses of different types of shots. South Korea's military says a barrage of North Korean missiles fired from both the ground and fighter jets has splashed down on the waters off the country's east coast in a major show of force on the eve of a key state anniversary in the north and parliamentary elections in the south. As the U.S. hunkers down to battle coronavirus, severe weather has left more than a million homes and businesses without power amid floods and mudslides. The storms that tore through the southeast on Monday left more than 30 people dead. Stay with VOA for all the very latest world news. Officials say Venezuelans who fled political and economic turmoil to neighboring Colombia have returned to their home country following a wave of evictions of migrants in Colombia amid a lockdown against the COVID-19 outbreak. Bogota-based journalist Joe Parkin Daniels has been reporting on Venezuelan migrants in Colombia and spoke to VOA's Jason Patinkin about their precarious situation.
Nearly 5 million have left Venezuela in the past few years, and the majority of those stay in Bogota. And obviously now, with these lockdowns, as a result of the coronavirus pandemic, these Venezuelan migrants and refugees are unable to do the normal jobs that they were doing, day-to-day living jobs, selling chewing gum and cigarettes at traffic lights, cleaning houses, everything informally being paid under the table. And so without that work, they're unable to make rent. They have been kicked out of their homes, and they see little alternative but to go back to Venezuela, where they at least have somewhere to stay, some family, some sort of network.
How many people are heading back to Venezuela or have already gone back to Venezuela?
The Maduro government in Venezuela has claimed about 9 days ago, 1,600 had gone back that weekend. The Colombian migration authorities said that 600 had gone back at that point. From my reporting, just traveling up and down the road, one morning, which was a kind of rainy morning, I saw three caravans of about 20 to 30 people in each caravan.
This doesn't sound like huge numbers of people who are going back, but it is an indication of how bad it's getting in Colombia.
Yes, exactly. This is the horrible situation these guys find themselves in. They are completely between a rock and a hard place. Venezuela has no effective health system. Venezuela has no effective distribution logistics network. Venezuela has no effective economy. We're talking about the country with the largest proven oil reserves on the planet that now has lines for hours and hours for people to get gasoline. This is a place that is as close to a failed state as you're likely to get in this region in modern times. And that's what these guys are going back to, which says that if that is preferable to them, it must be bad here. And it is bad here because, quite simply, there is no work. Lockdown is total, mandated quarantine at least until April 27th. Being on the street without a legitimate reason makes you susceptible to receiving a fine. And then we have the other issue, which is that it's the rainy season starting, so it's cold. These are not conditions to be homeless.
This issue of evictions, I mean, that seems to be just extremely cruel. In many parts of the world, there are calls for you know, rents to be frozen or put on hold in order to help people have a place to live during these lockdowns when they can't work.
There have been calls to not kick people out of their homes, not evict people. Even the mayor of Bogota has supported those. But ultimately, getting that kind of legislation doesn't make a whole lot of difference for the informal situations in which these people are. These are not registered tenants with documents backing them up. They're just paying as they go. $4 a night for a room that's effectively a shelter. Any kind of restrictions on evictions wouldn't really be felt there. Another consideration, these landlords typically are just also living kind of fairly day to day. They're running like very humble places and they have bills with gas, electricity, water, all of that's very high. So they have their own bills to pay. So it's a bit of a nightmare situation.
You met some of these people who are heading back. What were they telling you?
There was one guy working as a delivery guy in Bogota for a year, and he was traveling back with all his stuff, all his clothes in the pizza bag on his back. He, like everyone else, said, well, one day I'd hope to go back to Venezuela, but just not under these circumstances.
With all these people now potentially moving back to Venezuela, what kind of impact could that have on the outbreak?
The International Rescue Committee, United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, have voiced those concerns. When you have these people walking, they are not going to be being tested. They are more vulnerable to getting sick from anything, being relatively malnourished and walking hundreds of kilometers outside up and down mountains. And so the risk of exacerbating the outbreak in Colombia and Venezuela, where there are cases that are going up each day, is very high.
Global agencies have been warning that the coronavirus pandemic may result in worldwide food shortages, and leaders warn African nations already struggling from the effects of natural disasters and conflicts could be among the hardest hit. Nicolas Pinault reports from Paris.
Even before COVID-19 hit, 113 million people on the planet were already struggling with severe acute food insecurity due to pre-existing shocks and from natural disasters or crises. The worst examples are Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia, where the UN's food agency says 12 million people were already in dire circumstances due to the extended droughts, back-to-back failed harvests, and on top of it all, hordes of desert locusts that descended on crops and pastures between December and January. In an April report, the Food Crisis Prevention Network says conflicts have created food shortages and malnutrition in the Lake Chad Basin, the Liptako-Gourma region of Mali, Niger and Burkina Faso, and in parts of Nigeria. It says about 17 million people will face a food and nutrition crisis by June-August in the region. Isufu Bawa is an expert with the regional grouping, the Permanent Interstate Committee for Drought Control in the Sahel. He warns that 50 million people are currently stressed and in risk of falling into crisis.
Il s'agit en fait des populations qui sont à mesure de pouvoir assurer leur
alimentation. He explains to VOA that distressed populations can usually feed themselves but cannot manage any other non-food spending. If someone gets sick, for example, they would need to sell some of their food stock, which they rely on to survive, to cover the cost. Then he says they are in trouble. The coronavirus pandemic and the measures to contain it are also a challenge. South Africa has extended a national lockdown by 2 weeks until the end of April, as infections continue to mount. Others impose curfews. Despite border closures and restrictions within countries, food must remain available, says Sekou Sangare, the Commissioner for Agriculture, Environment and Water Resources of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. Sangare says the necessary lockdown measures should not prevent farmers from selling their products in the markets. Otherwise, he says, it would interrupt the food supply chain, create shortages, and increase the prices. Some NGOs warn that the remedy could become worse than the disease in countries with fragile economies. The effects of hunger could claim more victims than the virus itself, warned the group Action Against Hunger. Dr. Pierre Micheletti is its president.
Le confinement signifie la fin de l'emploi
Micheletti says lockdown measures mean the end of jobs for people who are trying to survive, mostly with informal jobs. He thinks the whole safety net system and monetary subsidies that developed countries can have are unrealistic in developing countries. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
VOA's international edition continues. Nigerian activists are marking 6 years since Boko Haram militants abducted hundreds of schoolgirls from the town of Chibok and kept 112 in captivity. President Muhammadu Buhari maintains he is still working to secure their release. Timothy Obizu reports from Abuja.
Alan Manasseh is sitting in his house participating in a live broadcast by the Bring Back Our Girls movement to mark the day 6 years ago when Boko Haram kidnapped 276 girls from a school in the Borno state town of Chibok. The virtual commemoration this year is due to travel restrictions imposed because of the coronavirus pandemic. Manasseh is the media and communications director of the Chibok community, a position he says he assumed to help his community fight for the release of the girls.
Related to some of the girls, about 24 are from my family directly, my cousins and nieces.
The audacious abduction of the girls by Boko Haram thrust the group and their brutal insurgency into the global spotlight. Some girls escaped soon after the abduction, and more than 100 others have since been freed through negotiations. But today, 112 are believed to remain in captivity, including Manasseh's nieces.
It has not been easy waiting for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, and then down to 6 years. It's not easy. That was why some of the parents died as a result of complications that had to do with blood pressure, you know, heart failure, kidney failure, and the rest. Especially the first woman that died after the abduction was my aunt, who had two of her twin girls abducted. Until today, they are part of those missing.
Advocacy group BBOG started a campaign in 2014 demanding the release of the girls. 6 years later, the group is still waiting, says one of its coordinators, Nifemi Onifadi.
Every year, we've had annual commemorations as well as other landmark commemorations in that time. And so today, like other days, we simply as a movement hold on to hope that they can still be found and make the same demand of Bring Back Our Girls.
Over the weekend, special prayers and Thanksgiving services were held in Chibok to mark the anniversary. President Muhammadu Buhari said no government official could attend the event due to the coronavirus lockdown, but promised that the girls have not been forgotten. Meanwhile, Nigeria is still seeing attacks by Boko Haram despite the coronavirus. One deadly hit in late March killed at least 50 troops. Military authorities say the soldiers were ambushed in Yobe State as they tried to launch an offensive against the group. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Former President Barack Obama has made a big announcement. As AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports, Obama endorsed Joe Biden via video, saying his former VP has the qualities we need right now.
Biden served two terms in the White House with Barack Obama.
Choosing Joe to be my vice president was one of the best decisions I ever made.
In a video, Obama called Joe Biden a close friend, the perfect candidate right now.
Joe has the character and the experience to guide us through one of our darkest times and heal us through a long recovery. And I know he'll surround himself with good people.
Obama rarely talks directly about his successor, President Trump. The endorsement gives Biden a big boost from the Democratic Party's biggest fundraiser. Barack Obama is expected to headline fundraisers for Biden and public events in key swing states if social distancing guidelines are lifted. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Hey, Jude.
Paul McCartney's handwritten lyrics to the 1968 Beatles song, Hey Jude, has sold for $910,000 at an auction last Friday. The sale held by Julian's Auctions took place in an online live streaming setting. It featured 250 items of Beatles memorabilia, including guitars and instruments, autographed items, rare vinyl, and artifacts. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Mwangagne, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Please take care of yourselves and be well.